conference record has joined the conference.
Hi folks, thanks for joining us. This is the EPA Brownfields RLS program webinar series, the first in a hopefully long series of RLF webinars for RLF grantees across the country. This is Megan Quinn in Washington, D.C. at headquarters. We're going to give folks, about two or three more minutes to sign on and get situated, and we'll get started.
Hi Megan. This is Karen Holmack out in Oregon. I went onto the website, signed on as a guest, and I guess, were we supposed to do that, and then you have to accept our request to be a guest?
Nope, you should be able to just log on as a guest. I don't have to accept anything. You just enter your name and enter as a guest.
Well, that's what I did, and it came up blank.
Okay, well, maybe sign out and try again. I have about 45 people in the room with me, so it seems to be working for a lot of folks.
Are we supposed to, I go through Mozilla, is it supposed to be Explorer?
I'm using Explorer. I'm using Explorer.
Okay, that might be my problem. Thanks.
Okay, if you can't see it, I can send them to you, or maybe folks in Region 10 can send it to you, and you can just listen. But hopefully it works.
Not working. Okay.
Let's see. Let me see. Is there anyone from Terry or somebody from Region 10 that's on that could send Karen the slides if I sent them to you?
Let me try Explorer first. Just
okay.
Let me try that first.
All righty. Okay, hi folks. For all of you that are just joining us, this is the EPA RLF webinar, the first in what we hope is a long series of webinars on various RLF topics for EPA RLF grantees. I'm going to give everyone about one more minute because we're still having a lot of people joining the room here. And we'll go ahead and get started in just a few minutes. If I could please ask everyone to please, please, pretty please mute your phones. I think that's *6 if you don't have a mute button. I've been on some long webinars this week already with people having some embarrassing conversations, and it's extremely disruptive. So if folks could please mute your phone, unless you have a question, it would be greatly appreciated by everyone. It looks like there's about 55 folks on the line at least, so please keep your phones on mute, and that'll be much better for everyone's participation.
Hi, Megan. This is Karen again. If someone from Region 10 could email it to me, that'd be great.
Okay. I don't even see anyone from Region 10 on. Is anyone, Terry or Deborah Burgess, are you guys on? Terry Griffith?
I'm on, Megan.
Okay, Terry. I'm going to forward you the slides, and then if you can send them to Karen.
You
may be having technical difficulties.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm working remote and I'm just not getting on, so.
Okay.
Thanks.
Get my email?
Yep, I have it.
Okay, thanks.
Megan, this is Kristen Heilman in Region 8, and I'm having the same issue. And I'm wondering if Stephanie Metz is on the phone, if maybe she could email me the slides.
Yeah, I'll send them to everyone right now, and then they can try to email them to you.
Thanks, Megan.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good point. For folks that are trying to see the slides, you may have a pop-up blocker on. A lot of folks are saying that their window opened in a different, or the presentation opened in a different window. So make sure you have your pop-up blockers disabled as well. That might be your issue. But your regional RLF contacts have the slides now, so perhaps they can get them out to you. And if not, these will be posted after the call. All right, we'll go ahead and get started then. First things first, welcome everyone. This is really exciting to be doing this. I know it certainly does not take the place of an in-person RLF grantees meeting, but the way the budget climate is and here in DC, our attempts to have another in-person RLF grantees meeting like the successful one we had in Minneapolis were not successful. So in lieu of that, we are going to try these webinars in the hopes of generating some sharing and discussion among the RLF grantees community and really making it more of a community, not just in your region, but nationally, because there's great things going on all across the country. So first things first, I'm Megan Quinn. I'm in the headquarters office here at EPA in the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization, and I'm the national lead for the RLF program. So we may have chatted in the past, or you may have seen my name in the RLF guidelines or RLF supplemental. I'm sure we've chatted at some point. I'd ask everyone, please, before we get started on the webinar, to please mute your phones. It's really important, and it upsets the enjoyment for everyone if phones are not on mute. So that is *6, and you can unmute at certain times to ask questions, no big deal, or you can type questions into the little chat box that you should see in front of you, and I will make sure that your question gets answered as well. So we have a great lineup of presenters. You won't have to listen to me for too long. You'll hear from a couple other folks in the region. First, you'll hear from Joe Ferrari in our EPA Region 1 office. That's out in Boston. Very knowledgeable guy about RLF. And then you'll hear from Mike Gifford and Carla Ocker of Region 5. That's out of our Chicago office. They're also incredibly knowledgeable, experienced RLF POs. And we'll have a quick chat with Ryan Smith as well. He's another colleague of ours here at headquarters to talk a little bit about requirements that come with reporting in acres. So we'll get to all that. I'm going to go ahead and get started and move on to the next slide. The first thing we wanted to do before we kind of delved into the TNCs is to go over some of the most pertinent RLF policies, things that, you know, you guys may not be aware of as RLF grantees because things do change. There are new policies that come on board. We make little tweaks to existing policies. So I'm going to run through 6 of those, and some of them are reminders. Maybe you'll know these, maybe you won't. And then Joe and Carla and Mike are going to walk through the key terms and conditions. We, of course, couldn't get to every single TNC, but we're hoping to review the key terms and conditions for you today. I'd ask that you hold questions until we've built in some times to ask questions. So after I go through all the RLF policies, if there are any questions you have, that'll be a time before we move on into the terms and conditions to ask those questions. Now, I understand this may not be the most exciting and sexy thing we talk about on these webinars, but this was a request from many of your fellow RLF grantees when we were trying to plan for this RLF All Grantees meeting that didn't happen. They said that this was a real key area that they wanted us to focus in on. So this comes not from what we think you guys should hear, but from what RLF grantees have specifically asked us to talk about. So the first one that I wanted to talk about in terms of RLF policies is the project period. I think folks are probably pretty aware that your original grant was awarded with 5 years, and there are options to extend that grant when you receive supplemental funding. And that ties right into the sufficient progress. There's a sufficient progress T&C that we'll go into more detail in a little bit that I'm sure you guys have seen, but it says that within 2 years, you need to have made one loan or subgrant or done a variety of other tasks like gotten your key personnel in order, you're marketing your RLF, you've set up your RLF operation, you're in the process of developing a loan or a subgrant deal. This sufficient progress T&C is really important, and the policy is if there isn't sufficient progress made in 2 years, this is grounds for termination and EPA taking the money back. This is really serious. This program is under a huge microscope, especially the RLF. There's a lot of dollars floating around nationally right now, and it's under a microscope not only internally here at EPA, which we are always getting questions about, but also Congress. So we really don't like to see the money just sitting there, and that's why we have the sufficient progress T&C, and we really try to follow it aggressively. That final bullet here is just a reminder that supplemental funding only adds 2 years to your grant. You shouldn't ever have a grant that's extended beyond those 2 years with your RLF supplemental funding. And that's why we ask for specific projects in our RLF, in our RLF supplemental funding requests the past couple of years. We don't have the money or the resources anymore to just allow supplemental funding to be bulking up, your bank again. We do understand that it's difficult sometimes to market your RLF when you don't have a lot of money in the bank, but you know, that's the whole point of the RLF supplemental funding requests for specific projects is you should really have projects that are ready to go, and you should be able to finish those within 2 years, and that's why we only add 2 years on for each RLF supplemental extension. And the next policy I wanted to walk over with you guys are these makings of the loans and the subgrants. You know, we really encourage you to pursue loans whenever possible. This isn't the revolving subgrant grant. It's a revolving loan fund grant. And, there are rules that we have that allow you to do a certain amount of a certain percentage for subgrants. But EPA really encourages you to seek out and find those loans that are going to get you program income. That's the point of this program, is to have you revolve the program, where you revolve the grant. So there is an allowance for a loan subgrant split. That's 50% of your funding can be for loans, and up to 50% of the funding can be used for grants. Some of you with older RLFs, you may still have the 60-40 split. You can amend your T&Cs maybe when you get that next round of RLF supplemental funding. You can amend your T&Cs to reflect this 50-50 loan subgrant split. You are limited to $200K per site with a subgrant. You can request a waiver of that $200K per site limit. You can also request a waiver of the 50-50 split. So we have done this on a couple of Recovery Act grants that if they have a really good project and we know we need to get those Recovery Act money spent, there are times where we have waived that 50-50 split and allowed to subgrant a larger amount. So you can work with your project officers on that. If there is a big project that comes up that they just won't take a loan, but maybe a subgrant just works a lot better, that's something to definitely know is an option for you and to work with your POs on that. Very important, though, when requesting the waivers, you have to send the request. You, the grantee, must send the request. It must be on your letterhead. You need to include a project description, and you need to talk about the jobs that are going to be created with this, whether they're temporary construction jobs, even if it's a park. There's got to be some folks that are working on this at some point. So even if they're just temporary jobs, you need to identify those and quantify that. You need to talk about other leveraged funding. Usually these are just parts of much bigger deals. We need to hear about all the other funding that you have attracted. And, you know, of course, other economic or non-economic benefits that may come from that project. The next policy, you guys are probably all familiar with this, but we thought it was important to go over. You'll hear us talk a lot more about program income in the terms and conditions. But just to remind folks that when you program income includes all sorts of things. So it's the money paid back to you on loans or fees you charge for certain things or, you know, any sort of RLF programmatic operation. You can also use your program income to meet the cost share from those various sources. You cannot use your actual loan principal, your actual base to meet the cost share, though. There are a couple of policies in place to help you deal with program income. You need to request a waiver from the grant regulations if you want to keep program income after closeout. Our old closeout policy, and this is kind of confusing, but our old closeout policy did not allow folks to keep program income. Now we do have a policy in place that with a waiver from the grant regulations, you can keep your program income after closeout. There's also a waiver in place from these same grant regulations that will allow you to spend your base grant funds before program income. Without that waiver, you have to tap into the program income before you're spending your grant balance. So really work with your POs when you're getting up to that point. I'm sure they'll help you out. But when you're getting ready to close out and you have all this great program income and you want to keep running your Brownfields program, there are ways that EPA now has in place to allow you to keep that program income from your RLF grant. And finally, if you do get a waiver to keep the program income after closeout, you must use it for Brownfields activities. This will be detailed in your closeout agreement that you work out with EPA, but it bears repeating here, and we'll say it a couple times throughout the terms and conditions. You need to continue to use that funding and report on it for Brownfields activities. Okay, discounted loans. Not sure how many folks know about this. This policy's been in place for a long while now, but maybe folks aren't aware of this policy. And we really see this as a tool to use. It may be helpful to you in packaging, you know, a sweeter deal for folks that are skeptical of getting a loan. So you can discount a loan up to 30%. It cannot exceed more than $200,000, but you can discount a loan up to 30%. So we gave an example. If you have a $600,000 loan, you can discount that loan 30%. So that basically is meaning 30% of $600K, $180K of the principal is forgiven for the borrower. You can do this for all sorts of folks. Can't do it for private entities. That's part of the policy. You cannot discount loans for private entities. All right, I'll just quickly go over this. This is a little repetitive, but it just bears repeating. For closeout policy and program income, you know, there are only two criteria for the closeout. You have to have your final payments made and completion of all cleanup activities under the grant are done. And as we said, the program income can be kept if you request a waiver from the EPA. And when those closeout agreements are signed, you have to continue to report to EPA how the program income is used. And as I said, when we get into the terms and conditions, we'll talk about acres and reporting on that. But it's really important that you keep reporting. We love to hear what's going on even after the grant has closed. It's important for the program. So I know it's a little repetitive, but bears repeating. And finally, the last policy we wanted to highlight is this idea of RLF grantees with insufficient capacity. We're really happy about this policy. We started it as a pilot many, many years ago, but only did it for a short period of time, I think in 2006 or 2007. But in February 2012, we instituted a formal policy that goes on in perpetuity that allows non-performing RLF grantees to close out their grant. And non-performing, we mean you haven't made a loan or subgrant, you haven't made any sufficient progress, or maybe folks just sometimes politics change, all sorts of things change. There may just not be a reason to be using the RLF monies anymore, but we still want to see brownfields cleanups in communities. So this allows you to close out and join a performing RLF as a coalition member. And this is great. So an example would be if you are a community in a county and the county has an RLF or a regional planning commission has an RLF, but you are just not able to move your money for whatever reason, you can close out your grant and join, your community can join as a coalition member to that performing county and still hopefully secure a cleanup or two in your community. 75% of the funds from the non-performing RLF will go to the performing RLF, will go to the grant that they are joining. And 25% will be sent back to us here at EPA. So really the goal here is to reduce unliquidated obligations. I said a moment ago that we're under a lot of pressure and under a microscope to move all of the standing money off the books. And we really want to reduce the unliquidated obligations but still ensure that cleanups are getting completed in your community. You know, obviously this would require a lot of detailed documentation. It takes folks a lot of months. It's not an easy thing to do, but it is an option for you and your POs. If they haven't already, I'm sure some folks will reach out to you. And if you're a performing RLF grantee that knows of some communities that are struggling, this may be something that you wanna, that has an RLF that you may want to broach with them. It's important to note that the non-performing RLF won't be penalized. You're not going to be penalized. You're not going to be put on some blacklist. We're not going to say, oh, they couldn't perform. They shouldn't apply for any brownfields grants. That's not at all. So the RLF just isn't for anyone. It isn't for everyone. Some folks just can't get it off the ground, and that's no big deal. I think folks are happy to take the money, and we're happy to help you look at something that may be a little more manageable for your community. So at that point, I'm going to stop. We are going to start talking about the RLF terms and conditions, but I first wanted to check to see if there were any questions.
I have one question regarding program income when it comes to closeout. If we have loans, obviously we still have repayments coming. How are those repayment funds handled, or is that part of the agreement with the closeout?
That would be part of your agreement.
Okay, thanks.
Oh, there's two questions that were typed in. The first one is, are discounted loans available for intragovernmental loans? I believe so. I don't see why not. I think the only prohibition would be on would be on private entities. I don't know, Mike or Joe, do you?
I'm not aware of any, but I'm not aware of any specific prohibition against it, Megan.
Yeah, I'm not either. So I think that would be okay.
Yeah,
the second question. Oh, go ahead,
maybe
sorry.
The only thing would be it depends on what you mean by intragovernmental, as long as it doesn't affect the subgrant to yourself rule. You can't subgrant to yourself, so it would have to be a definitely different organization.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it's intragovernmental, if you mean you're loaning to another arm, then you couldn't do that.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just to clarify, is state government considered one large lump, or is it broken down by departments and agencies?
State government would be considered one large lump.
Okay, you can. Yeah, you can't do, like, an interdepartmental discounted loan.
Megan, I'll throw one example in Michigan. In Michigan, there are what are called brownfield redevelopment authorities that are established under state statute, and they're oftentimes very closely tied to the local unit of government, but they are distinct and separate legal entities. And if the city is a grant recipient, they could make a subgrant to the brownfield redevelopment authority, as long as that brownfield redevelopment authority owns that site.
Okay, that's a good example. The other question Deb had was, how many closeout agreements have been executed? Oh, my. Who knows, Deb, as many RLF grants as we've closed out. Sure, it's a lot. We have a lot of examples, and your POs have a lot of examples of closeout agreements that you could look at.
We probably have 15 or so in Region 5. Does that sound reasonable, Carla?
That sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
I'll talk about closeout agreements in the latter part of the terms and conditions.
Mm-hmm.
I think in Region 1 we have about 10, but then we have more closeouts that did not have anything or were not going to generate any program income, so there was no agreement. So it would vary. Some people long ago did not spend all their funding on loans, or they got their loans paid back before closeout, so there was no program income to be realized. So there is that possibility.
Okay, thanks. All right, we don't have any more questions, so let's move on to the terms and conditions, and I'm going to turn it over to Joe Ferrari of Region 1 in Boston. And, Joe, I think you're going to run through the next few slides, right?
Yes.
All right. And I think you have access so you can move through the slides. Can you see if you can?
Yep, it did work.
Oh, good. Okay,
I'm
super.
In good shape.
Okay. Take it away.
Okay. Here are the seven terms and conditions that are contained within the whole programmatic terms and conditions for the RLF. Of course, there are administrative ones that come from the grants office. And this format is following the current terms and conditions that we attach to grants right now. Some people that have very old RLFs, they may not yet have the new up-to-date ones, but for the most part, this is what people are seeing. So there are these seven terms and conditions, and there are the Davis-Bacon terms and conditions as well as those. What we have to present today are really the key ones. So we're not going to talk about the general requirements because those just basically set up the start of what the rest of them are going to follow. So we're going to dive right into site eligibility. And under site eligibility, this is where you can find what needs to be done to determine whether the site and borrower and subgrantee eligibility is for the sites that come into your program. In the first section here on this slide, what we're looking at is site eligibility itself, and the term and condition informs you that it needs to meet the definition of a brownfield site. It has to identify the owner and has to have date of acquisition. That information, of course, is necessary to determine if that site is an eligible site. Some of the other parts of this section of the terms and conditions go into property-specific determinations and petroleum. And I believe we had discussed that the second most requested item for a webinar was site eligibility. So that's going to be coming up. So at this point, we're not going to delve too deeply into site eligibility. But in our experience over the years, there are many ways to look at and many options to work on when going over site eligibility. So there are many things that we've done and we can do to help with site eligibility. And again, and we'll say that in the next section, site and borrower and subgrant eligibility are really specific to the project. So you would need to really talk to your project officer when a project comes to you to see if it's eligible or if there are ways to make that site eligible and bring it into the program for cleanup. Getting more into the borrower and subgrant recipient eligibility, the terms and conditions here inform you that the subgrants can only be made to eligible entities or nonprofit organizations that own the site. So subgrants have to be made to an eligible person or entity, and they have to own the site at the time that the subgrant is made. The second part here says that the recipient has to own the site throughout the period of the subgrant, and that the cooperative agreement recipient cannot subgrant to itself, as we touched on a few minutes ago. Also here we have the CAR can discount loans up to 30%, but not to exceed the $200,000 per site, and cannot discount loans to private entities, and I think we touched upon that as well. Also here we can find that the CAR cannot loan or subgrant funds to an entity that is potentially liable under CERCLA. So again, the subgrant recipient or the loan recipient cannot be liable for contaminating that site, and they would have to have a liability protection. That's really, we'll get into that in a second, but let's move on to the next item. For petroleum sites, a person cleaning up the site must not be considered potentially liable for contamination, and also the CAR needs to maintain documentation for all the sites to support the eligibility of them. That means the sites, the borrowers, and the subgrantees. And also here we find the borrowers and subgrantees must submit information regarding their environmental compliance history at the site, and the cooperative agreement recipient must use this to evaluate business risk, and that really goes towards loans, but also to subgrants, because obviously if you're giving out funding, whether it be loan or subgrant, you want to make sure that either you're going to get your money back if it's a loan, and if it's a subgrant, you want to make sure that entity is viable and is going to be around to finish the cleanup at the site. And the last item here is an entity that is suspended, debarred, or ineligible cannot be a borrower or subgrantee. I think there's a lot of questions here right now. Do we want to take them? Because this is, you know, a pretty intense subject. Megan, do you want to do some Q&A right
sure.
now?
Sure. So I'm seeing one from Pam Homer that says, the question is, making an eligibility determination. Oh, she's asking, making an eligibility determination is an eligible or ineligible programmatic cost for the CAR. Yeah.
It's definitely an eligible cost.
Right.
Right, because you have to do that to determine whether the site or borrower or subgrantee can be brought into the program and that you can fund that cleanup.
Right. And then Paul Morano asked, does a discount loan count toward the 50% grant portion of the program dollars?
And yes, it does. That would count towards the 50% of subgrant. So basically, a discounted loan could be looked at as a subgrant packaged in with the loan for all intents and purposes, if that makes sense. In other words, it's one way of doing one loan document but also providing a subgrant as well.
Joe, it's Trevor Borgai with the City of Gardner.
Yes, Trevor. How are you
doing? In relation to that last question, the 30% discount, if you had a grant, a $200,000 grant on a property and a loan, could you give that 30% discount on top of that $200,000 grant?
It's still $200,000 per site unless you seek a waiver.
All right.
And there is that option of seeking a waiver for that.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry, just Karen, a question that's a follow-up to that waiver. How high a waiver can you request?
That's a question for Megan to answer.
Yeah. there isn't a set limit, but I can tell you that we would look very, very skeptically upon something that, you know, went too far over the $200,000. We have done some fairly large waivers for the Recovery Act dollars. We see those as dollars that we really needed to move, and that was more critical. But we really, we would be very skeptical of a large, say, request for a $500,000 subgrant waiver. That would be met with great skepticism. So there isn't a limit. We have not set a waiver limit, but the closer to $200,000, the better.
Megan, in Region 5, I think probably the majority of our waiver requests have been anywhere between $250,000 and $350,000 as a total cost, so we might be requesting a waiver of an additional $150,000.
Yeah,
that's the rule, and there have been a few exceptions, but generally they're $350,000 or less.
Yeah, I was going to say that I feel like that's a good average, Mike, $250,000 to $350,000, so $150,000 at the most over.
Yep, that makes sense here. I mean, in Region 1, we haven't done too many of them, but I think except for the Recovery Act funding is where we did the most of them. But for the most part, we look at it as this is just a little bit more over $200,000 that will complete a cleanup and get it done. So that's really our justification among the jobs and the benefits of the community, but also it makes it possible to complete the cleanup.
Mm-hmm. We just have two more quick questions, and then we'll go on to the next slide. Benny wanted to know if we can close out an RLF grant, if that money was used for gap funding at a larger cleanup project, and that cleanup was not completed. So I think the answer is yes, as long as the cleanup is completed for the portion that you've paid for under your RLF grant.
Yes, I think we've looked at it that way, too, here in Region 1, and that's somewhat rare, but it can happen.
Right. So as long as the cleanup activities that you funded are completed, then that wouldn't hold up a closeout.
Same approach in Region 5.
Mm-hmm.
And one last question before we move on. Someone's asking how you determine whether an entity is suspended, debarred, or otherwise ineligible to be a borrower or subgrantee. And I would assume you would have to ask them, or there must be some sort of grant database you could search to find out.
Yes, there is. I mean, that's a lot of contracting officers would do something like that. So probably your organization has somebody that when you do your normal contracting, you look to check and see if somebody is on a list of, you know, people who have either a federal, state, or otherwise. That would be the problem. Be probably where you'd find that red flag.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
I was going to add one quick thing. As a grantee, you're oftentimes developing an application form or an application process whereby you evaluate the viability of a project above and beyond our requirements. And one of those questions you should be asking is if they are or have been disbarred.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
Clearance question.
A lot of those things are probably looked at, especially for your financial manager. Right, when you're looking at a loan, definitely.
All right, let's keep going, Joe, because we're only on slide 13. We only have about an hour to go. So,
I think what we talked about, though, is that this is such a big subject, and the terms and conditions go beyond here to talk about the specific liability protections and such that are mentioned here, and that's really the subject of a whole webinar. We could really get into this a lot more detailed than that. So
absolutely.
That's probably our best bet.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, as you said, I think our next webinar will be on just the eligibility questions, the eligibility focus.
Okay. So the next section that we want to delve into is the third major group of terms and conditions under General Cooperative Agreement Administration Requirements. And under this, there are sections that cover the administration of the cooperative agreement, and they're, you know, the first two parts, we don't have them here. They're just the term condition agreement and EPA involvement. And I believe, Megan, you mentioned earlier about the 2 years, and that's where that's covered under this general number three, the General Cooperative Agreement Administrative Requirements. That's where it talks about the 5 years and after 2 years you need to have made a loan or made sufficient progress. But we're going to cover this area here, which is the cooperative agreement recipient roles and responsibilities. And that really gets into that the actual grantee, you, are responsible for establishing the RLF team to implement the RLF program. And the team that you gather together is very critical in running your program efficiently, properly, and getting in the loans and getting in the subgrants to do the cleanups. So you need to have or acquire a qualified environmental professional to help you oversee the cleanups, to make sure they go smoothly, to make sure they're completed under the correct state program or tribal program that you're doing the work under. Also, you need to act as or appoint a fund manager to carry out the financial management, and that's the person who's going to look at the viability of the applicant for loans or subgrants. They're going to maybe collect the money. They're going to manage the program income for you. So they're a very key person in your team. Also, you also have to appoint or obtain legal counsel to help review the loans and subgrant agreements to make sure that all the proper terms and conditions that go in that those documents are in there and satisfy your local requirements, maybe state requirements, and certainly the federal requirements, which will be talked about later, which are later in the terms and conditions. And also, here we see that the CAR is responsible for ensuring borrowers and subgrantees comply with all of these terms and conditions, and they put them into their loans and subgrant documents, okay? So moving right along, the other item here is reporting, and reporting is very key. This is where we take credit for what's been done out there and all the good work that you're doing on your sites. So I'm going to turn this over, I guess, to Ryan, and he's going to talk to you about acres.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to come on for a couple of minutes and tell you a little bit about acres and what we do with the information that we collect in acres. ACRES is a database that we take all the accomplishments that everybody reports back to us on, and that's what we use to develop our congressional justifications and our budget questions and answer budget questions about what we do with these funds. And the reason that this is important is that just like you guys as local government officials or state government officials, we have to justify our budget to our appropriators, and the biggest tool that we have to do that is ACRES. It tells us how many different kinds of accomplishments that we get out of the different kinds of funding that we use. And of course, you know, the RLF program is critical for meeting cleanup goals, but it's also very, very important toward meeting the goals that go toward leverage funding, leverage jobs, and ultimately acres that are made ready for reuse. And so the URL for acres is epa.gov/acres. And what we do is we ask that once you guys receive your funding package and find out about what your grant number is going to be, once you have that, you can go in and you can register for ACRES. You can look around the system, and you can take a look and see what there is to see. Ultimately, you're going to want to work very closely with your project officer to make sure that we get all sorts of really good information about the projects, the good projects that you guys are going to be working on. And if you need to ask any questions, I'm more than happy to serve as a resource or definitely ask your project officer.
Okay, thanks, Brian. I'm also under this section, of course, is the quarterly reporting and the local reporting that needs to be done as well. Moving right along then into financial administrative requirements, here's where it talks a little bit about the cost. There's a little section about the cost share before the eligible uses of funds, and it sort of goes together because your cost share, of course, also must be eligible funding. It must come from eligible items that we'll cover right now. So some of the eligible programmatic expenses that we cover here in the terms and conditions are really the site eligibility, which I know that was something that was asked a few minutes ago. So here's where you can find that answer now. Other items that you need on site, such as fencing, warning signs, security, or other site control precautions, anything that's going to keep people safe during the operation of the site. Obviously, the preparation of the analysis of brownfields cleanup alternatives, that is an eligible cost. Ensuring the public participation requirements are met, and including doing and completing a community relations plan is covered here. Also eligible are any costs in establishing the administrative record for the site so that the community has a place to go to see the information pertaining to the site, any removal of drums, barrels, tanks, or anything that contains a hazardous substance or petroleum item. Moving on to the second slide, they're also developing the quality assurance project plan that will be required for any testing that's being done in association with the cleanup or the confirmatory sampling after the cleanup. Ensuring adequacy of the cleanup and overseeing the activities to ensure compliance with federal and state requirements. So that's someone going out and making sure that the site is being cleaned up properly. Those are normally the expenses of your qualified environmental professional. Ensuring the site is secure if borrower or subgrantee is unable or unwilling to complete cleanup. So if something goes wrong and the borrower or the sub goes bankrupt, or the subgrantee is no longer able to complete the cleanup, making sure the site is secure, and either fencing it in or making sure there's nothing that people are going to be affected by, that's an eligible expense. Purchasing environmental insurance to cover the cleanup of the site is eligible. And also, there are other eligible programmatic costs out there. Here in subgrantee progress reporting, I think this other eligible programmatic costs is a good lead in here to talk about these projects that you're doing. Certainly you're going to be talking to your project officer since it is a cooperative agreement, and that's where you're going to discuss these items. And if there's at all any question at any time that you're not sure that this is an eligible cost, please talk to your project officer, and then you can work out whether that cost is truly a cleanup cost and it's eligible. Also under this section of eligible uses of the funding, 10% of the funding can be used by the actual cooperative agreement recipient for program development and implementation, which is more likely health monitoring or institutional control work that may go with the cleanups that you're doing under your grant. And also, if you, as the cooperative agreement recipient, make a subgrant to a local government, and this is a local government only, that includes 10% for this type of work, then you have to make sure you maintain adequate records. Again, I want to emphasize, if you're not sure if it's an eligible cost, to talk to your project officer. Did you want to take any more questions now, Megan, or shall we move on?
Let's move on. There's just one question right now, so we'll go a few more slides and then take questions before we go to Mike.
Sounds good to me.
Actually, I did have a question, but and it deals with the community plan and what can be that can be comprised of. But if you want to take that later, I can hold on that.
Well, go ahead and ask your question.
Sure.
In the community plan, I have a project where it looks like it may be possible to engage a school with, and I'm looking at a curriculum. And with the cost of acquiring the curriculum and implementing the curriculum be considered part of the community outreach plan? And because the whole curriculum is focused around the Brownfield site.
And that would then be, in other words, it's really tailored to the cleanup of one specific site, and it would engage that you said it was a school in what's going on at the site?
Right. There's a curriculum that's been developed, Our Town, and it goes through junior high through senior high that can be focused on the math and the science issues associated with, addressing contamination. And in this case, there happens to be a property which has been willed to the school for the proceeds to go into a scholarship. And the idea is to engage the school to utilize this curriculum to really have the students understand what is going on with this piece of property and utilize the lessons that can be learned from just understanding the environmental condition, what the cleanup would entail, ongoing monitoring, that sort of thing, in terms of the math and the science aspects of it, as all part of the package of this property being cleaned up.
It certainly sounds possible, but I don't know if I think someone would have to take a look at that and really make that determination for that specific
circumstance. Yeah, I think that's something you need to work more closely with your project officer on. Then we could make a determination right here because that's a lot of we'd have to look at it.
But it
the
would
only
be
other option
worthwhile to look at.
Yeah, the only other option I was going to throw out is that it might be fit within the general definition of community outreach, where you're engaging the community, so it's above and beyond the site-specific community involvement component. That's a possibility, but as Joe and Megan mentioned, this is something that you'll probably want to discuss in more detail with your project officer.
Okay, thanks.
Right. Ultimately, it sounds like it's something that would really engage the community around the site. So it certainly meets that the obligation of really involving the affected community. But whether the specifics of it, I think it's the specifics of it that really need to be looked at more than its concept sounds really good.
Yeah. Well, why don't we move on, Joe? And just as a reminder for folks, when you're asking your question, if you could just say what region or what city or state that you are from, that would be really helpful, especially for the EPA POs that are on so they can know who's asking the question. Thanks. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. There is a question about what is program development. And I think program development that we just talked about before is really to, in the way I look at that, and because it's not defined specifically here, is just trying to work through getting your team developed and also getting your outreach developed and your marketing developed. I don't know how others look at that, Mike, if you have any other input
on that. That's exactly how I would look at it.
Okay.
What internal processes are you going to have in place to evaluate an individual or a potential borrower or subgrantee that comes in the door? I mean, if it's a loan, do they? How are you going to evaluate the viability of the project? Is there a revenue stream to repay the loan? So that's all part of your program development. There's going to be some things you're obviously going to have to incorporate into it that meet EPA requirements and your terms and conditions, but there are going to be other elements that are going to be unique to your particular program.
Correct. And there was in the past a specific requirement to do a program development plan, and some entities even that we have in our region, in Region 1, since they're a planning commission or otherwise that want to maintain a transparent program, actually put together an implementation guide to help inform them and their steering committee members as to how they're going to actually look at sites, process loans and subgrants, what they're going to look at, and how they're going to maintain records, and they go through the whole variety of issues just so that everyone is aware of how they're going to implement their program. So I'll go right into the next slide then. In looking at the eligible costs that we just have, here are some specific ineligible uses of the funds that are actually called out here in the terms and conditions. And this is not a comprehensive list, but it's some of the more common things, which again would be here assessment or pre-cleanup assessment activities, which is your phase one or phase two, monitoring and data collection for permits under federal or state laws, unless they're actually required by the specific cleanup chosen at the site. Non-cleanup related construction, demolition, and development of the site is also addressing deteriorated drinking water supplies is specifically called out here. Any job training that's unrelated to the actual cleanup at the site, paying a penalty or fine for the site or the site cleanup, meeting a federal cost share requirement unless allowed by statutory authority, paying response costs to the site where the recipient of a loan or subgrant is liable under CERCLA 107. That gets back to looking at the eligibility of the site and the borrower and subgrantee first to make sure that that doesn't happen. And also paying a cost of compliance with any federal law not applicable to the cleanup. So those would be some of the things that are ineligible. Our next slide here gets into the specific administrative costs, because administrative costs are not allowed, or any indirect costs are not allowed. And that can be, those specific items can be, can be found under the OMB circulars. Some of them are ineligible administrative costs like salaries and benefits and contractual costs and any of those costs that you would find under the specific regulations depending upon whether you're a municipality or a nonprofit. Also, there's a whole host of things that are listed here in this term and condition. A lot of them go into doing brownfield grant applications and record keeping and maintaining a financial management system and non-federal audits and overhead and a lot of other items like that, so you can find that here. I think the rule of thumb is if the cost applies to anything but the cleanup at the site or something that applies to just running your organization and is not directly related to running the RLF or site cleanup, then it's probably an eligible cost. And if it's an ineligible cost, then it's not covered here. You'd have to find another source of funding for it. And again, I would ask you to talk to your project officer to discuss it, because all sites and situations are different. And that would make sense to check that out before you proceed. The next slide gets into the use of program income, which was talked about earlier. Here's where we find what you can do with your program income. I mean, the first step of program income, when it comes back to you through the repayment of loans and subgrants or interest, repayment of loans and loan interest, and it also can be the account interest that you earn on the money that you put into an account. Also, any fees that you may collect when you are doing your loan program. If you're going to have a loan application fee or a closing fee, that would be considered program income, and you'd put it in this account. and then any other RLF operation that brings in funding, and there could be a whole host of things for that, but it would be any funding that is not the actual repayment of federal funding would be considered the program income that you're putting into the program. For really old grants that I don't believe we have anymore, you could transition, when you transitioned your RLF grant, then the program income would carry over. So some people still have a few of those transitioned grants, and any program income that had been earned before they transitioned is incorporated into this new grant that they have now. And the last item, again, is that the CAR can use the program income from the fees, loan interest for the cost share, and I know Megan covered this already, as long that you can use some of these items to meet your cost share, but you cannot use the loan principal to pay for that. And that's where that is all covered here. Next, we have the CAR must maintain adequate records on the use of program income and return any ineligible costs to the RLF. So here's where you need to make sure that you have adequate records to make sure that your program income is coming in and being used for eligible costs for running your program and then making other loans and subgrants. The next term and condition gets into if you make loans and subgrants with combination of actual grant funding and program income, they're, of course, subject to these terms and conditions. The next one talks about whether or not you're giving out a loan or subgrant entirely with program income. And it does say that you need EPA approval on substantive terms and terms and conditions of the loans and subgrants. But I think, I know in our region, mostly we've been going through the loans and subgrants with our grantees in the beginning of their program, and we're usually pretty comfortable that they have their bases covered by the time they get to this point. I don't know if you have any other comments on that, Mike, in your experience.
Completely agree with you.
And then the last item here under financial management is the post-cooperative agreement program income, and that's the in program income you're going to receive after you have a closeout agreement. And this is here, this section here will just discusses, again, maintaining adequate records to document your compliance with using the funding per the negotiated closeout agreement, and also that we can request access to those records to verify that you're doing what you said you were going to do in your closeout agreement. And that's pretty much the major items within financial administrative requirements. Next, I'm going to turn it over to Carla and Mike. Unless we want to take some questions, Megan? I don't see
any
here.
Yeah, why don't we? Yeah,
is there anyone on the phone?
I see one question actually here that I'll read.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, it says, can cost share match come from partners who are not formal coalition members?
Megan, this is Carla. Do you want me to answer that?
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out because, I mean, yes, go ahead. Maybe Wendy could clarify a little bit what she was asking there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because I'm not really clear on what you mean by coalition.
Yeah, me neither. Maybe,
yeah.
Okay.
Wendy?
Can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Okay. What I was meaning is the formal coalition members who were awarded the grant are working with another partner who was initially a formal member, but there was kind of an administrative slash legal snafu, and they got their status as a Montana state organization taken away, but they're still very much functioning and working, you know, in this redevelopment realm. And they still are a partner and working with the whole coalition that received the RLF. So they're all working together as partners, and they're wondering if this entity can you know, through whatever means they have to provide match, to provide people working on the sites, to provide administrative support, if that can be counted as match on the projects that they're working on in that geographic area.
Megan?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes?
Okay. Megan, do you want to take that, or do you want me to take a stab at it?
Well, I'm sorry. I thought you were answering Carla.
Okay. I'm sorry. I was going to, but then I was like, she's not asking the question I thought she was asking. But I would think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Megan, but I would think that if they're doing in-kind work, but they're not a coalition member, that would not be able to be counted as match. However, if they have a project that this agency that used to be a coalition member is a part of that project, like it's one that, you know, they own the project or they're involved in the project, and they want to pay for some costs, like some cleanup costs that would be eligible for match, then that would be considered an eligible match. Because it wouldn't be like they were giving money as a separate entity. They'd actually be doing work on the site, this eligible work that the entity who is cleaning up the site would use then as match. I hope that's
okay.
Clear.
Yeah, it is clear. Thank you.
Okay.
And that is
Does that sound reasonable, Megan?
Yeah, I was thinking it would be a stretch the way it was described. So, yes.
Okay.
I agree.
And I will continue to follow up with it, but that's helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, just have them put their money towards a project that needs match, because we don't care who. When we get a loan or a subgrant and we pass that match along to the loan recipient or the subgrant recipient, because that happens 9 times out of 10 on the RLS that I work on, that we just pass that 20% cost share on to that subgrant recipient or loan recipient. And we don't care where that loan recipient gets the money that they use to conduct the eligible activities.
Mm-hmm.
So they can just pass it right on to the loan recipient. Okay.
Okay, great. Thanks. Why don't we keep going on slide 24
okay.
then? I don't see any other questions right now.
Okay, this is Carla Auker. I'm in Region 5. I'm a project manager, project officer for a few RLS. And I'm going to take the next four slides and then turn it over to Mike Gifford, who's really our RLS expert in Region 5. The first slide that I'm going to address talks about the ABCA. And for anyone who's familiar with the classic Superfund site, you can think of the ABCA. It's called Alternative Analysis of Brownfields Cleanup Alternatives. That's what the acronym stands for. And it's really the brownfields equivalent of a feasibility study. That's where you're going to want to and where you have to document what your thought process was when you chose what cleanup alternative, you know, chose your cleanup alternative. So you need to make sure that this ABCA includes documentation of what contaminations on site and what the cleanup alternatives are that you've considered, as well as a no-action alternative. And you need to talk a little bit about the applicable laws because you need to meet those applicable laws. And you talk about what, you know, the proposed cleanup is. To give you an example of that, these ABCAs can be either very short or a little bit longer. I mean, they could be 2 pages long if it's a very, very simple cleanup, say an asbestos cleanup, and your cleanup alternatives are removal, encapsulation, and no action. Now, in that case, it's pretty cut and dry what what your three alternatives are. The one thing that I want to bring up as a point with these ABCAs is if you've got a more complicated site, you want to make sure that the ABCA documents all the cleanup alternatives that have been considered. And you may even want to consider talking to the community and doing some community involvement and get their ideas on cleanup alternatives as well. And the reason I say that is
for instance, I've got a site that I'm working on, and it's an old confined disposal facility for dredge material. And there are several ways we can address the small amount of contamination. It can be capped. You could do a dig and haul, which you just dig the contamination up and take it away and then backfill. You could fence the site. And then there's the no action. Those are the things we talked about in the EPCA. Well, we didn't even consider boardwalks because this area is a big area for birders. Well, we put out the EPCA. You have to put your EPCA out for public comment. It has to be available for public comment for 30 days. And we got responses back for our EPCA because some people in the community said, well, why don't you use boardwalks? Well, that just slowed our whole project up because we had to respond to those comments and then justify why we weren't going to use boardwalks. So I just want to, you know, in thinking about the EPCA, I want to make sure that everybody understands you want to definitely make sure that you put all the different alternatives that could be considered in the EPCA. The analysis of the cleanup alternatives must include the effectiveness and the implementability, like how easily implementable the remediation is, and the cost. And you need to make sure that the cleanup method, when you justify your cleanup method, that you mention each of those alternatives, each of the criterion, the effectiveness, the implementability, and the cost. The implementation for the, you know, number B, the implementation of the RLF cleanup activities, the cooperative agreement recipient needs to be sure that each RLF cleanup is protecting human health and the environment, and include the loan and subgrant terms and conditions to allow for changes in the cleanup plan based on public comment. Once again, that goes back to, you know, make sure that if you sign your subgrant or loan agreement before the APT is approved, make sure there's a contingency in there that says that the cleanup alternative can be changed. Okay, the next slide. Any questions on that? Megan, I can't seem to get mine to go down. There we go. Let me get my down twice. Megan, I'm losing control. I don't have control over the slide.
Oh, I got it because it went
okay,
to
thank C. You.
You're on slide 25. Okay. Yeah. I don't know why
okay,
you're not a presenter now. Sorry.
I don't know. I thought maybe it was just me.
I'll add you back.
Thanks. Once the cleanup that's being done by the RLF loan or subgrant is completed, you need to have a letter from a qualified environmental professional that says that the cleanup was completed and met all state and federal applicable laws. And you also need to have a letter from a state or tribal government that documents that the cleanup was completed in accordance with their laws. Now, in states where there's a voluntary action program, this is a pretty easy thing to do because we typically require the applicant to become a member or to join into the voluntary action program and enroll the site in it. And you get, through grant-funded technical assistance, you can have the state entity review documents all the way along, and they're willing to write the letter. Now, sometimes we have, there are some regulatory programs like an asbestos cleanup, where it's either a self-certifying program or the program's been delegated essentially down to the qualified environmental professional. So in that case, we will sometimes, you have to work with your project officer on this, sometimes we'll accept the letter from the qualified environmental professional that states that all the state regulations have been met. We'll accept that in lieu of the state or tribal cleanup documentation. The environmental requirements, there's a lot more environmental requirements in the terms and conditions. So make sure that you look at those and understand how they apply to your cleanup. For instance, the Davis-Bacon Act term and condition, as well as the National Historic Preservation Act term and condition. You need to work in some instances, you'll need to work with your National Historic Preservation Office to make sure if there's going to be a cleanup that's going to involve having to take down or take windows out of a building that's a historic building. Okay, Megan, next slide.
Oh, okay. I think you're a presenter now, so I think you can guide them.
Oh, I can do it.
I gotcha.
Okay.
Yep, I gotcha, though. You're on that.
Okay,
on
very good. Thank you. The next slide deals with revolving loan fund requirements and the prudent lending and sub-granting practices. Number one, the CAR needs to establish economically sound structures, management, and processing procedures to maintain the RLF and meet the long-term lending and sub-granting objectives. This bullet really is just dealing with, you make sure when you put your loan program together and as you're deciding what loans and sub-grants to give, make sure that the projects that you're funding meet and go along with the master plan that most of you have probably presented in your grant application. The kinds of costs that you incur as you're putting to establishing your loan processing structures and those kinds of things, those are eligible costs under they're administrative costs that are eligible to be paid for from the grant. These are the administrative costs, not programmatic costs, I'm sorry. The one thing it says, the CAR shall not incur costs until the work plan is approved by EPA and ensure objectives that the work plan are met. The activities may include consider awarding subgrants competitively. In Region 5, I don't know of any grantee who has ever run a competitive process other than with the stimulus money. We have one grantee who did that. And they ended up basically funding the majority of the applicants who came in. But it was just a way for them to screen their sub-grantees. You need to establish appropriate project selection criteria. This needs to be done in the you're going to do that right after your work plan when you put in your application for federal funding. You're going to, once again, you need to look back at what your master plan is, whether you have priority areas that you want to focus on. And if you've got a high priority on, say, for instance, transportation in your area that you're going to do the loans in your geographic area, that's the kind of thing that you're looking at for appropriate selection criteria. And make sure that you establish the threshold eligibility requirements. That goes back to some of the things that Joe was talking about, making sure that the grant recipient is not a potentially responsible party under CERCLA. You need to develop formal eligibility protocol for potential borrowers and sub-grantees. Once again, that goes back to coming up with what I suggest to my grantees is they come up with an actual form that that asks all the eligibility questions. You know, when did the subgrant recipient or the loan recipient, when did they purchase the site? Did they do all appropriate inquiry before purchasing the site? So that we can make sure that both the site is eligible and the borrower, the subgrantee, is eligible. You want to require the borrowers and subgrantees to submit information on their environmental compliance history. Joe touched on that as well. That's something that typically will be done by the legal counsel that you have on staff or have hired to help you put together your loan program. You need to establish procedures for handling management and processing of loans and repayments. Typically, that's something that's done internally within the cooperative agreement recipients. Within their organization themselves. Say, for instance, if it's a city, you'll end up working with your legal department as well as your finance department to make sure that you have your procedures for bringing the money in and then processing it and getting the payments out meets essentially the city requirements as well as the 30 CFR requirements for spending money. You need to establish procedures for the disbursement of funds to the borrowers and subgrantees. I'd like to talk a little bit about this bullet. just because there's a number of ways that you can do your disbursements. Some grantees will have the applicant or have the subgrantee or loan recipient give them submit invoices that then the cooperative agreement recipients review the invoices and then will make payments directly to the subgrantee or loan recipient, and then that loan recipient will pay their contractors. You can do there's a way that you can do like scheduled payments, and that's something that we haven't done very often, but that's addressed in the terms and conditions as well, where if you've got a project that you pretty much know what the pace of the project is going to be, you can set up where your disbursements to the loan recipient or the subgrantee will be like on a month, X amount on a monthly basis, that sort of thing. The bullet at the bottom of the asterisk at the bottom that you must include special terms and conditions in the loan and subgrant agreements, that goes back once again to some of the things that Joe touched on. You make sure that you look at your terms and conditions, make sure that all the cross-cutting requirements that are required in your cooperative agreement are passed on to the loan and subgrant, into the loan and subgrant documents. Make sure that if applicable, that the National Historic Preservation Act is included. And then if it's a cleanup program project, almost inevitably you're going to have to comply with Davis-Bacon Act requirements. And I think this is where I'm going to pass this off to Mike.
Okay, thanks, Carla. I think we just have one question, but I'm going to go ahead and have Mike finish his slides since we're butting up to 4:30 on the East Coast. And then if we go over, no big deal, but I just want to make sure for folks that have to sign off right at in 10 minutes that we get through the whole presentation, and then we'll go through and get the questions answered. Does that sound fair?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you, Carla. Mike, you ready?
On.
Hmm? Mike?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. I get inadvertently muted. A lot of the things in these last six slides have been covered. I'm going to focus on a couple of things. The payment schedule, item number one, where it talks about EPA making payments to the CAR, in reality, this term and condition is a little antiquated. For new grant recipients, what you will do is you will set up an automated standard application for payments. It's generally referred to as ASAP through the Treasury Department. And this is a one-time enrollment, and grant recipients will initiate the payments through the ASAP system, and then the system is designed to provide funds to you within 48 hours. My understanding in talking with grantees in the region, it works very well. And for that reason, I'll talk about the three options that are presented in the terms and conditions, and Carla touched on this. We really strongly encourage the use of actual expense when disbursement requests are made, and that it's invoice-based. There is a mechanism, and it's in the next two slides, that talk about a scheduled payment, or on slide 30, if there's a full disbursement made at one time, a lump sum drawdown. Those are things that we discourage. Because of the rapid turnaround that you generally see with the ASAP system, the invoice system is by far the better way to go. Now, the second bullet on page 28 touches on the use of program income prior to requesting funds. I know this has been discussed, but this is a very important point, that if you have accrued program income during your project period of your cooperative agreement from a loan repayment, closing costs, or other fees, the grant regulations require that you use that program income before you draw down on your cooperative agreement balance. So it's very conceivable that you might have a loan or a subgrant that includes both program income and then is supplemented by the balance of your cooperative agreement. Okay, moving on to 29, I touched on 29 and a little bit with the actual expense versus the schedule. Again, we strongly recommend the actual expense because of the ease of the ASAP system, and the terms and conditions do provide for it because the grant regulations provide for it, but I am not aware of any situation personally here in the region where we have either used the scheduled system or, as slide 30 indicates, the full disbursement. The only situation I would view that a full disbursement would be relevant would be is if you're going to be doing a massive dig and haul, and it's going to be over a very short period of time, and you're expecting a lot of invoices to come in that very short period of time. That would be the only scenario that I would see it being relevant, but you need to get upfront approval from the EPA project officer for that. And item D, subgrant funds must be distributed in accordance with sections 3121 and 3122. Basically, what these talk about are the methods by which payments are made to grant recipients and subsequently to grantees or contractors. And within the grant regulations, it actually identifies the reimbursement method as the preferred method for reimbursing, which would be the invoice. Moving on to slide 31, two criteria for closeout. So you've reached the end of your project period, and you've made your final loan. Once you are ready for closeout, when all the cleanup activities have been completed at your site, and final payments have been made for those cleanup activities, and you've taken your cooperative agreement balance down to zero or very close to zero. At this point, what you will do is you will enter into the closeout agreement that was discussed a little earlier with EPA. You'll enter into a closeout agreement with EPA that dictates how that program income that is received during the term of that closeout agreement will be used, plus any program income that you had accrued prior to closeout. And again, if you had accrued program income prior to closeout, you're still ready to close out, that's when you would seek a waiver of the grant regulation that would allow you to keep that program income. EPA encourages you to use that program income for loans to sustain the program, but almost every closeout agreement in Region 5 affords the grantee flexibility as to how they want to use those funds. Maybe it's for other brownfield activities. Maybe you want to help a prospective borrower conduct their due diligence as part of an overall package to incentivize the project. So you may actually use some of your program income during the closeout period to do a phase one or phase two. None of the term and conditions that were in your cooperative agreement apply to the closeout agreement because the cooperative agreement has been closed out. The only carryover from the terms and conditions is item number 4, which applies to the CERCLA 107 prohibition and site eligibility. In other words, you cannot make a loan or a subgrant, or you as the grantee or former grantee can't be liable for contamination at the site. The term of the closeout agreements in Region 5 are generally 3 years. I believe other regions may have them up to 5 years. From Region 5's perspective, we want you out of our hair as quickly as possible, and I'm sure you would like us out of your hair as quickly as possible. But at the end of that 3 years, that closeout agreement can be mutually terminated. Final requirements, generally within 90 days of the termination of your grant, your grant management office should submit you a letter that indicates what needs to be submitted as part of the closeout process. This includes the final report, which may be your final quarterly report that includes your accomplishments during the term of the cooperative agreement, the final financial or federal financial report, and the final minority business women business report. And we also want to make sure that you have entered all the necessary property data into ACRES. Lastly, slide 33, recovery of RLF assets. In the case of termination for cause or convenience, we will sweep the funds from the cooperative agreement as described in this term and condition. Megan touched on earlier one of the policies, which is the underperformer. If you've just not had success in marketing your program, that you can join an existing coalition and 25% of the funds would be returned to headquarters and 75% of the funds would go to the coalition, lead coalition member. Loan guarantees, it is a provision that allows you to use RLF funds for a loan guarantee. I'm not aware of a situation where this has occurred. In effect, what would happen here is the funds would be held in escrow unless there is a loan default. The escrow would be held in an independent financial institution that documents it has made a guaranteed loan in exchange for access to the escrow funds upon default. Upon release of the escrow funds, after the cleanup is complete, it's back to business as usual. In the event that the cleanup occurs after your project period is completed, or the cleanup is completed after your project period ends, then a closeout agreement could be negotiated at that time that would allow you to keep that escrow once it has been released, assuming there wasn't a default and the funds had to be used for cleanup. And that's it. Any questions?
I have a question regarding our RLF program here at the City of Rockford. We have both a petroleum supplemental RLF and a hazardous substance RLF, and we are in the process of completing, spending the and loaning the $700,000 hazardous, but petroleum, we still don't have a project. We thought we'd have one by now, but we still don't. Is there, a general process that we, where we could actually close out the hazardous one once it's paid back?
No, it's there's not a provision for partial closeout of a of a grant.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Are there other questions for Mike or Carla? Carla, there was one question on from Deb 2 a while ago. I won't read the whole thing just in the interest of time, but from Minnesota. But at the end, she's basically saying that the ABCA is burdensome and it just ends up being an extra piece of paper for them and their deals because their sites are often already enrolled in state programs that have considered these things. And she asks, what flexibility for the ABCA process can you suggest? And I would just say, I don't think there is one because we have to do the ABCA to comply for in our part for the Brownfields program with NEPA, but I wasn't sure if you had anything to add or if you had any insights there.
Well, the only insight that I have is if you are ever audited by the IG and there's question as to whether your funds were spent judiciously or whether you evaluated how those funds were going to be spent, you're going to be very, very glad that you have an ABCA that documents the fact that you looked at cost versus benefit for all the different possible cleanup remediation alternatives. So, honestly, there's really not a way around it. The ABCAs that we have that we've produced in at least in Ohio have, like I said, been anywhere from 3 to 10 or 12 pages, which if compared to a feasibility study under classic CERCLA cleanup is pretty, I think it's pretty lenient. It's a pretty bare bones document. So I'm sorry that you think it's burdensome, but it may come in handy someday.
And again, it's a requirement of our grant for the EPA. It's an important piece to EPA.
This is Joe in Region 1. I'm not really familiar, obviously, with that state's program, but a few of our state programs in New England have a requirement built in to their state cleanup programs that they will do an analysis. And that analysis that they require, it pretty much covers what we ask for in our alternatives, in our ABCA. So really it's one in the same, and we usually accept that document as the ABCA. We don't make them do a separate document because it already covers all the elements that are required in an ABCA anyway. And one in particular, and even I think there's two states really that actually have a requirement for putting that plan out to the public. One state does it for 2 weeks. So in many cases, I'm sorry, I think it's 2 weeks, if I'm not mistaken. That pretty much covers that requirement. So if it can be timed correctly, then they've covered their whole ABCA requirement within the state cleanup program, and we don't make them do it again.
Okay, so a little bit of difference.
Sometimes you can make it work with the state program, and sometimes you can't. It's all in the timing.
Right. Okay, well, we are up against our hour and a half that we allotted for this. I wanted to check one last time to see if there are any last quick questions. Okay, we really hope that this was helpful for you. I would appreciate any feedback, both positive and negative. If you have 2 seconds, you can type it in now or send us or your PO an email. We would love to hear if this met some of your needs and if there are other topics you'd like for us to cover on future webinars. I'd like to do these webinars every 3 or 4 weeks for the next few months at a minimum. And so we would really appreciate any feedback. And again, we'll post these slides to our RLF site here at headquarters, and we'll make sure to get that URL out to everyone so you can access these. I also recorded the webinar so you could listen to it again if you'd like. And we really appreciate you guys joining us. We know RLF can be a really challenging program, and we're really trying to help folks on a national scale to move that money and find projects and get those brownfield sites that you know are in your communities cleaned up and back into productive reuse. So Joe and Carla and Mike, I really appreciate your time, and we really appreciate all the grantees for coming on. And please be on the lookout for our next webinar and send us any comments or feedback. We'd really, really appreciate it. And thanks a lot. Have a great rest of your week and long weekend. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Megan. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.